All right, here's another week of it all. Oh boy, what a fucking weekend they've had over in the States, huh? This episode will kind of reflect that as articles more trend towards it again and things that have saved throughout the week. And fuck, I've got a lot of links again. Like, how many articles do they go through in the regular podcasts? You know, the Buena Vistas, the Chapos, all that sort of shit. It's like, what, maybe three? I'm doing way too many. Like, if I even saved, like, five articles a day over the course of the week, that ends up being 35. That's a lot. I really need to chill the fuck out with what I think is relevant and newsworthy. I'll work on it a bit. At the moment, no one's listening, so I've got no feedback. So I'll just keep going as is, and then later on I can decide what to cut. But this, at least this one's got a lot of quick shit that I don't need to talk about for too long. So hopefully this won't be another hour-long episode. So let's get straight to it. This is mostly on social media, but I got this from Ultimate Guitar. It says here that Faith No More keyboardist's new musical project with boyfriend removed from YouTube for sexual violations. So this is if you're familiar with the band Faith No More, you may be aware that their keyboardist, Roddy Bottom, is gay. Never had a chance. And I guess because they've been pretty chill at the moment, because they haven't put out a fucking follow-up to Sol Invictus yet, and it's been like 5 years, that he's doing a solo project. He put a bunch of stuff on YouTube and Instagram, and it got removed for being too gay. So, fuck YouTube, fuck Instagram. Let Roddy Bottom do his thing. He's a fucking legend. Here's another one. I'm going to gloss over this quickly from the ABC. From heirlooms to IKEA, why we need to understand our furniture for a sustainable future. And this article follows a couple called Nicola Pitt and Jorge Basave, who this article makes out to sound like the biggest fucking cunts on earth, that they were living out in Alice Springs for a while, and they said it was easier for them to buy flat pack furniture from Adelaide and ship it up to the Garn than go the nearby Harvey Norman, which, you know, Harvey Norman aren't really known for good quality furniture either. They've got expensive furniture, but it's not fucking good. And it says here, which is what really adds to their cuntiness, is we move around a lot, so we don't really need to accumulate furniture that is going to weigh us down and that we have to ship from one place to another. Oh yeah, good for you that you're not stuck in one fucking place, so you need to constantly buy cheap, shitty furniture. No sympathy from me. Then this goes on for a bit of generic shit about, you know, all that woke consumerism bullshit that we know we should buy less, but it's a bit hard to overcome that desire, and that good furniture is being replaced with cheaper furniture, which means it's light, it's shit, it breaks easy, and there's nothing you can do after that than just chuck it out. And that as a result, there ends up being a lot more waste in the world. They got a quote here from a doctor. It was a designer and sociologist, Leila Arakoglu. So that's not quite like that fucking celebrity book curator, that wine cooler or whatever his name was, but this is up there. But you know, she makes the point here that we've seen the transition away from more durable materials to kind of cheaper, lightweight, and often more convenient product that makes it easier for us to go and buy something, pop it in a house, and then when we're moving, we accidentally damage it and ends up on the street. This article was of interest to me because if you read the book Cryptonomicron, there's a section in that where a guy is talking about his desire for heirloom-level furniture. That's something that we see disappearing more and more. And this is, he was thinking about when, like, grandparents die, they've always got this just massive, solid, indestructible furniture that everybody wants because it's not going anywhere. And he's like, where does this furniture come from? The grandparents bought it, so it has to be out there. And how is there not more heirloom-level furniture entering the market? And that's after reading that, I was like, when I finally stop fucking renting, if that ever happens, and I get to move in somewhere, that you know I'm going to fill that up with that massive, solid, indestructible, heirloom level furniture. My kids will grow to hate each other after I die trying to accumulate all of my shit. That's what I'm trying to do. The other half of this article goes on about similar instances of that, of people with actual decent furniture that you stay attached to and you want after people die or leave or move on. And then it just ends with how everything's going to shit and sustainable doesn't mean expensive. There's a lot to this article. I'm not going to fucking dwell on it. All right, here's another one on the Flight Center saga that I've been following with glee. From Mumbrella, Flight Center's COVID-19 response was a flight plan to failure. So if you've been listening to previous episodes, which no one has, you'll know that Flight Center is going to shit at the moment because of COVID-19. And this article highlights how Flight Center CEO Graham, nicknamed Screw Turner, and that's what they fucking call him there at work, is Screw Turner, because, yes, you know, the soulless drones that run everything would like to be perceived to have a personality. Well, this is what he said about it all, that in regards to announcing 100 stores to close, it would have happened anyway. The coronavirus just makes it that we'll shut them a little bit sooner than we would have otherwise. So there you go, employees of 100 Flight Center stores, that your stores would have closed anyway. Which ones would it have been? Well, you'll never know, because coronavirus came and shut them all down before they made the hard decisions beforehand. Yeah, I think this is a very convenient fucking excuse. And it's the article points out, why say that? No expression of regret or empathy. When he went on to explain, we've got $1.3 billion in cash on our balance sheet, so we're feeling fairly strong. So you're closing down 100 stores, but you've got $1.3 billion in cash. How would you feel hearing that from your fucking CEO, as, you know, this fucking top of the tree cunt that you've never even met before, who's in charge of everything to do with your job, which occupies most of your life, says he's going to shut your store down, it would have happened anyway, and then the company has $1.3 billion in the bank, apparently, and that they'll be able to ride through this. So, yeah, here's some more quotes from old mate Screw. These employees are people that we do not want to lose. We hope to bring as many of them as possible back on board when conditions improve. They've been stood down out of necessity, not removed from our business permanently. You know, it feels a lot the fucking same when you can't pay your rent. But, yeah, so there's a lot going on here. You know, yet weeks earlier, Flight Center announced it would permanently close 428 stores and would seek $900 million in fresh equity and debt. So much for feeling fairly strong. But these tone-deaf messages are overshadowed by the company's mishandling of its cancellation policy, which is what I talked about last week, where they're trying to charge people for cancelling just about fucking everything. And they wonder why everybody hates them and they want nothing to do with them. And this article also has some generic fucking points here on important lessons for this pandemic. Demonstrate empathy and regret for all your staff and customers. The crisis is not all about you. Isn't it kind of fucking sad that needs to be bullet point number one to CEOs and management in regards to a fucking pandemic? I'm not going to dwell on that any longer. Here's one from The Conversation. Celeste Barber's story shows us the power of celebrity fundraising and the importance of reading the fine print. So if you can remember way back when we were being ravaged by bushfires, comedian Celeste Barber put out a GoFundMe just to raise a bit of money to help the fire brigade, because they had like fuck all resources because of austerity politics. She ended up raising $51 million. And now the problem's become, what the fuck do you do with all the money? Because there's a lot of problems here. The beneficiary was the trustee for New South Wales Rural Fire Services and Brigade's Donations Fund, and the target was $30,000. The fundraiser went viral and saw millions of dollars pour into it from around the world. As donations skyrocketed, Barbara told her fans via Instagram she planned to spread the money raised around. Quote from her there, "I'm going to make sure that Victorians get some, South Australia gets some, also families and people have died in the fires, wildlife." So she raised a ton of money. The problem is, it's not that simple. Because, as it says here, the RFS donation fund is governed by a trust deed, which limits what it can use donations for. This means it can only spend funds received on equipment, training resources, or administrative costs for RFS brigades. It does not allow donations to be passed on to fire services in other states or to other charities. Given Barbara's comments about how the donation should be distributed and the intense attention on the issue, the RFS sought the advice of the New South Wales Supreme Court. So, this is a bit of a case of paperwork getting in the way and red tape and whatnot. But yeah, unfortunately, because the intended beneficiary was the RFS and they raised so much more money than they had to, that now they can't just give out the money to more people. It's kind of weird that they're going to the Supreme Court, not as like a legal matter, but like for advice. They're like, how can we get around our own rules to actually fucking help people? It's ridiculous. It goes on to talk about lessons that we can learn, and there's a lot here because it's the conversation and they're all a bunch of nerds that write for it. The main lesson is that you set up a fundraiser or looking to donate a particular charity, do some due diligence first. Which, this is one thing I'm sure a lot of people would criticize Celeste Barber for not doing this beforehand and trying to get all the paperwork sorted out when raising money. But initially she was only looking to get 30 grand specifically to help the RFS. And when it blows out to 51 million, which is an insane amount of money, hundreds of times more than she intended, then you're kind of like, well, we can't just give $51 million to the fucking RFS. For example, the National Charities Regulator, the Australian Charities and Not-for-Profits Commission, has a free public register where you can look up information about individual charities. To be fair to Barbara, she did only intend to raise $30,000 for the RFS, and only expressed a desire to broaden the beneficiaries of a fundraiser when it took off. How often does a fundraiser function beyond expectation? That's part of it too. Like, I feel like fundraising is usually the sort of thing, you have a goal, divide that by 10, and you're getting close to what you're realistically going to get. So, yeah, when does it actually happen that you go out to raise money and get more than you wanted? I've heard there's a bunch of things that could go on, like they could potentially start their own trust to put the money in and then they can delegate things from there. It's like, it seems like the problem is all these rules put in place to try and stop fraud and whatever else, which is just getting in the way of things here, and that unfortunately a lot of these other options as workarounds would be more conducive to fraud as well. Not that anyone would do that, it's just, it could make it look bad. When you're operating your own trust and things get obfuscated, it would be easier to slip some other shit in. Oh, this is running along. Let's try power through this. Okay. Here's one from the Sydney Morning Herald. MAGA hat and Maori gaffe. New Zealand opposition leader's first week. So this is as probably everyone's familiar, that New Zealand has the Prime Minister Jacinta Ardern. I think she's in a similar situation as Justin Trudeau, where overseas she's heralded as a bit of a progressive icon, but nationally in her own country, she's done some things that make her not super well received. So if you were a smart opposition, you may actually be able to do things to get her out. It doesn't seem to be the case here with the New Zealand opposition. So quick context is... New Zealand opposition leader Todd Mueller has suffered a string of race-based embarrassments in his first week in the job, but on his chance to leave Kiwis with a good first impression. Mueller seized the Nationals' leadership on Friday, using horror poll results to justify a successful move against Simon Bridges. Now, big note here in the article is that Bridges was the first Maori leader of the country's major conservative party, with fellow Maori Paula Bennett as his deputy. Exacerbating the problem, new deputy Nikki Kaye on Tuesday falsely claimed finance spokesman Paul Goldsmith had Maori heritage. Goldsmith corrected her 5 minutes later. "No, I'm not Maori," he said sheepishly. Mueller defended his choices, saying under his leadership the broader team would play a big part. The caucus is diverse. We have 55 people coming from a huge amount of different experiences, gender, ethnicity, work experience, he said. So it's that. He's trying to swing the whole thing that more people in his cabinet are women, as if, you know, that representation will mean anything if the policies don't benefit them, that they've got no Maoris on their in their cabinet. And then also the quick mention here is that on the radio, Mueller insisted he was standing by extending the age for superannuation access in New Zealand to 67. So, yeah, that's fucking great, isn't it? That you topple the first Maori leader of your party, don't instill any Maoris in your cabinet, and then accidentally lie about the heritage of one of them because you haven't done your research. And then, in one of your first appearances in that week, you tell everyone that you're going to increase the age in which they can access their superannuation. But that's not all. And then there was a small matter of his MAGA hat, popularized by US President Donald Trump. Mueller has been attacked for displaying the red Make America Great Again hat in his office. Many see it as a symbol of extremist views. That's the article there. That, of course, we all know that it is the shitty red hat of racism. The 51-year-old countered by saying it was merely a souvenir from a trip to America in 2016, when he also attended Hillary Clinton's convention. So, yeah, he's not actually a fucking racist, because even though he was given the hat and displays in his office, he also went to the other side's convention, as if there's a fucking difference. Next one, from The Age, fast food giants roll out staff temperature checks. So this is talking about how, a McDonald's spokeswoman on Tuesday said workers at some Victorian outlets were not allowed to start their shifts unless they took the temperature test conducted by their manager. Those with temperatures above 38 degrees had to go home and talk to a doctor. Now, these temperature checks aren't rock solid. They're not the best way to assess whether you are viral or not, and a lot of people are not happy with it. As Josh Cullinan, Secretary of the Retail and Fast Food Workers Union, said the checks were a gross invasion of privacy and some McDonald's workers had been told they were mandated by Victorian government. He claimed the devices used by McDonald's were uncalibrated and its managers untrained in their use. They probably went down to JCAR and bought a bunch of non-contact thermometers and they just point them at your fucking forehead and see what they say. Workers were not consulted about the policy or given any opportunity to voice concern, he said. So, yeah, Another point here, as I've highlighted, University of Sydney global health scholar Adam Camrad Scott said, if used, temperature checks should be deployed only as part of a broader suite of measures to stop the virus's spread. Associate Professor Camrad Scott said the SARS outbreak had shown scanners were highly inefficient at detecting cases because people frequently took paracetamol, which artificially lowered their temperature and masked the virus. He said a small percentage of the infected people would not develop a fever and others might be ill but not yet showing symptoms. So, yeah, that's just fucking great. The McDonald's, which there's been a string of clusters around already and a couple of them have shut here in Melbourne, still want to stay open so we can go buy their shitty-ass fucking burgers, are just going to scan their employees' heads with a fucking non-contact thermometer and if you're over 38 degrees, send you home because you might have the virus. Even though everyone that works there probably needs the money and is going to be taking whatever drugs they can to mask symptoms and bring their temperatures down, which is probably how the fucking delivery driver got it to start with. So I have been trying to ignore the deals in the McDonald's app because there is a McDonald's walking distance from my place with everything that's going on. And reading that, I'm going to be trying to stick it out a bit longer. All right, here's another one. Make Solo 2 Happen, Fan Campaign Demands Star Wars Sequel by IGN.com. This is a mix of things, I think. One, everybody is really bored right now. And two, I think it's news of the Snyder Cut, which was discussed in the last couple of weeks, that people have decided that, hey, you know Solo, that Star Wars movie where two of the most bankable directors got booted off it, it ended up costing a shit ton of money because of reshoots and then underperformed, you should make another one of them. I watched it. Solo was a decent movie, but I really can't see a direct sequel happening. As it says here, there's a hashtag, Make Solo 2 Happen. Everyone is just going fucking nuts ever since this whole Snyder Cut thing was announced. because it's not this article, but it's another one. I'll get to it, but just, yeah, Star Wars. I haven't even watched the most recent one. Maybe we should put it to bed for a little while. Here's another one again from Collider. Girl with the Dragon Tattoo series in the works at Amazon. Books won't be used. So this is just getting the character of Mrs. Dragon Tattoo, and pretty much they're doing their own fan fiction of the adventures of the Dragon Tattoo Girl, as the article says here. Amazon is developing a series centered around Stieg Larsson's feminist hero Lisbeth Salander. They'll not use the author's Millennium books. Instead, the resourceful hacker will feature in all new stories and situations. That's... I tried listening to Girl with the Dragon Tattoo as an audiobook. I couldn't do it. It was so fucking boring that I think a big part for me is that the opening first couple of chapters just spend so much time talking about business deals and the specs of computers from the early 2000s that I have a business degree. That sort of shit's not interesting to me. That if anything, I want nothing to fucking do with it outside of the fucking scraps of a professional life that I have at the moment. So, not my cup of tea. Also, the couple of chapters that I listened to where old mate Stieg was describing Lisbeth, it sounded a bit like he was typing one-handed as he described his imaginary goth GF. But as the hook here in this article mentions, meanwhile, the larger story here is Amazon's new literary strategy. As Jennifer Sulk wants the streamer to become the official home of all your favorite airport books. So it's pretty much going to become the OK Boomer streaming service. Amazon already has a Jack Ryan series and a Henry Bosch series. It is currently casting a Jack Reacher series. It's developing an Alex Cross series too. If only Amazon could find a way to acquire the Lincoln Rhymes series from NBC, then it would really be in business. So, yeah, they're just this is what it is. They've got the Jack Ryan series, which is that series of books that your dad liked. They're now adapting the Millennium series, which is that book series your mum liked, that your parents don't give a fuck about local businesses, so they're going to just sign up to Amazon Prime. Now they can just play these boring TV shows in the background while they look at Facebook on their iPads and have toilet paper delivered to them with free delivery. Next one here is just more of a quick follow-up to a previous thing I discussed. Tom Cruise's outer space shot movie with Elon Musk and NASA Lance director Doug Liman. Now, the connection here is Doug Liman worked with Cruise on Edge of Tomorrow and American Made, apparently. I don't know what the fuck that movie is. So, look, this is from a Variety. They just flesh this out to hit that SEO-friendly 300 words. I think that's the hook of it, because there's not a lot of details around it other than that. Another one from ABC. Deliveroo sued for unfairly dismissing worker it accused of being too slow. So, key points. Diego Franco is suing Deliveroo for unfair dismissal. May be considered a test case for workers in the gig economy who want more rights. Demand for food delivery services has surged to unprecedented levels. So, big hook here that Diego Franco came here from Brazil. Deliveroo became his main job, and he's been working at it for 3 years. But at the height of the pandemic, Deliveroo sacked him in late April for essentially being too slow. Now he's suing the food delivery giant at the Fair Work Commission. Depending on what the FWC decides, this test case might set a precedent with expensive consequences for Deliveroo and its competitors in the gig economy. Mr. Franco says, Deliveroo says Mr. Franco frequently took significantly longer than expected to complete a high number of deliveries, according to an email sent to him on April 23rd. Now, as Mr. Franco had has mentioned, that you get paid fuck all doing these jobs, so it's in your best interest to deliver everything as fast as possible. And so, why would someone take longer than necessary to deliver food? Also, he'd been working with them for 3 years, which apparently doesn't count for shit to Deliveroo. There's not the only ones. Uber Eats have been accused of imposing unfair contracts, and this article links off to an ABC investigation reveals that Uber Eats contracts may breach Australian consumer law. As it mentions here, the minimum wage is $19.49 per hour. Now that's gone up since last time I checked. Mr. Franco says he was paid, on average, $10 to $12 per delivery, and it would be tough to earn minimum wage on a quiet day. So with that, it's pretty much you have to do two deliveries an hour to make minimum wage. The greater extension here is the argument over are they independent contractors or employees? Because, of course, none of these companies, from Uber Eats to Deliveroo to ManyLog, want to actually be to have to list these delivery people as employees. As it says here, around what Mr. Franco would need to do in this case, to succeed, he had to convince the FWC that he was really an employee and that Deliveroo had engaged in sham contracting. And sham contracting is in quotes there. I'm assuming that's the actual title. So this does exist as a law here in Australia. Basically, that means misrepresenting its employees as contractors, who are their own bosses running their own businesses, that's in parentheticals, to avoid paying minimum wage, annual leave, sick leave, superannuation, and other entitlements. Also, employees are protected by unfair dismissal laws, contractors are not. The food delivery business relies on low-cost, on-demand workers who are generally not paid an hourly wage. If Deliveroo and rival Uber Eats and ManyLog were forced to reclassify their riders as employees under the law, that would threaten the viability of their business model, with labour costs skyrocketing. So, yeah, as I mentioned in a previous episode, the food delivery is just not a profitable business to operate solely in, because it's a means to an end. Nobody wants to do it, and they want everything as quickly as possible. I don't think it's perhaps the best large-scale option, but back in my hometown, a lot of the food delivery places there actually had a decent model, where if you worked for one of the pizza places that did delivery, the pizza places had their own cars, and if you were a delivery driver, you were there on-site working for that company, and if things got really busy, you'd go help out in the kitchen. And it's something that a lot of people that had regular jobs would actually do on the weekends to earn a bit more money. I understand that's not viable for a lot of people, a lot of businesses, but that seems like the closest thing to a sustainable model is you hire your actual delivery drivers, you try to highlight delivery as more of a service that you offer to people than just a little side thing, and then because the delivery drivers are working for you, when things are busy, they can help out in other ways. It's not gonna happen, is it? Here's another one I'm gonna breeze over quickly because fuck this shit. It's a BNT top 10 Bunnings, Woolies, and Qantas, Australia's most trusted brands during lockdown, as CBA's fortunes fly. So, this is apparently research firm Roy Morgan has revealed in April. Australia's in deep with COVID-19 lockdown. So this is probably the top 10 companies that paid to be placed in this list. So we go here. Let's go from bottom up, make it interesting. Number 10, CBA. Number 9, Bendigo Bank. Number 8, Coles. Number 7, Australia Post. 6, ABC. 5, NRMA. 4, Aldi. 3, Qantas. 2, Woolworths. 1, Bunnings. So I don't see how the fuck this is happening. Let's work through this list a little bit. Number 10, you got Commonwealth Bank of Australia, who first of all are a fucking bank, and then have been fined for facilitating money laundering, and got a hearty slap on the wrist during the Royal Commission. After that, you got Bendigo Bank, whose entire model is to open branches in rural towns and then charge fees for everything. Coles, who are owned by Wesfarmers, where most of their money actually comes from mining the coal and iron, so they're destroying the country. Australia Post, who are underfunded and don't give a shit. ABC, only decent bit of centrist news. NRMA, insurance company. Aldi, who the only reason they give their employees chairs at the checkout is so they don't need to take breaks. Qantas, who pay no tax. Woolworths, who, when spending all the money to expand into Masters to take on Bunnings, decided that they would just keep the prices in their supermarkets up because they were already the leading supermarket and figured that because of that, that customers would just pay the premium. And then Bunnings, who refused to give me a job for being overqualified and have destroyed pretty much the all local hardware retailers by just opening their big warehouses and undercutting everyone. Pretty much, if anything's a massive company, that you shouldn't fucking trust them. And the only reason we go to these ones is because there's nowhere else to go. Fucking hell. Fuck this shit. Fuck these companies. I try to avoid them if I can, but you can't, can you? When there's only two supermarkets in the country, where else do you go? All right, here's another follow-up from Bleeding Cool, because we do quite like them here. Zack Snyder's Justice League isn't Snyder Cut. It's complex. Radical. So this is more based off an interview with Warner chairman and HBO Max head Bob Greenblatt, more or less confirmed in a new interview that it is complex and radical. Because turns out that there wasn't just a Snyder Cut sitting on the shelf ready to go. I'll keep reading. It was on the Recode Media podcast. He was speaking about the project and why it took so long to get greenlit. Greenblatt not only confirmed that the Snyder Cut never existed, but that bringing Zack Snyder's Justice League to life is a much bigger and more expensive undertaking than anyone seems to realize. And in the quote here, it's talking about how it's quite tricky because since they're using a mix of existing and new footage that they have to shoot, they need to talk to unions, talk to producers, figure everything out. And here, just this last fucking bit. It's a radical rethinking of that movie, and it's complicated and wildly expensive. Of course, a number I won't quote. I'll just say I wish it was just $30 million. It's an enormous undertaking and very complex. What the article does here is a good point afterwards. For anyone looking for an idea what kind of money that is, The Invisible Man, which came out earlier this year, was made with a budget of $9 million. So, this is the thing I just can't fucking believe. The director, they kicked off this project because he was making such a bad film that then just, it didn't underperform at the box office, but it was tepidly received. That they're going to give him in excess of another $30 million to try and polish this turd. I'd like to go and make a fucking list of all the movies that cost less than $30 million and that we could have got another one of them for the reshoots that they're going to do on Justice League. But the end of this article has what shows just how bored and desperate for content everyone is. As for the internet, they seem to have thrown their support to David Ayer and getting his version of Suicide Squad released next. Maybe don't send threats to critics and journalists this time, and you won't become a joke. Zack Snyder's Justice League will premiere on HBO. Yeah. I feel like there's too many streaming services and they're struggling for content. That you would want to give Zack Snyder and David Ayer cuts of their own shitty superhero movies. Here's another one from The Conversation. Incel violence is a form of extremism. It's time we treated it as a security threat. So this is a bit of a spicy take, which is absolutely fucking true. It opens here saying, last week, a 17-year-old boy in Toronto was charged with an act of terrorism in the alleged killing of a woman with a machete. I had that open as an article to read a little while ago, but I thought, no, that's just too sad. But this is a different take on it. The first time such a charge has been brought in a case involving incel ideology. Also last week, a 20-year-old man who self-identified as an incel, short for involuntary celibate, allegedly went on a shooting spree in Arizona, targeting couples to express his anger over the fact women had rejected him. These are just two of the most recent attacks attributed to incels. Incel-related violence has been on the rise for the past 7 years, and according to our research, has been linked to the deaths of at least 53 people and scores of injuries. It's just in the fucking name, isn't it? Involuntary celibate. That, as if it's only up to you, that you're saying, oh, I can't have sex and it's not my choice. It takes two people to have sex. So it just means that you're so unappealing to everyone else that no one wants anything to do with you. And you're saying that it's involuntary because as if there's something greater stopping that from happening than who you are as a fucking person. It's so interesting because it's like the title is indicative of the problem. There's a lot in this. And this article is also set up to explain what an incel is to all the old people reading this article. But here's just another thing I wanted to touch on. According to the Incel Wiki website, these men view Chads as the only male beneficiaries of the sexual revolution. They hate Stacey's because they are vain and obsessed with jewelry, makeup, and clothes, and are entitled whores. Okay, this is part of it as well. Incels, part of their whole thing, is they're angry and pissed off at a fictional person they've invented whose name is Chad Thundercock, and that every woman's name is Stacey or Veronica, and this imaginary Chad Thundercock is off having sex with all of them, and there's no sex left to be had with these incels. It's fucking ridiculous. Like, how could you start getting into the incel ideology and not be like, this is all pretty fucking stupid and weird? But here's another thing that's more of a spicy take in this. Something that a lot of people probably won't like to hear, but if you subscribe to the idea that there is an incel ideology and mode of thought, it says here that incel extremism fits the definition put forth by Home Affairs for violent extremism, which has here is the use or support of violence to achieve ideological, religious, or political goals. However, Home Affairs apparently does not view misogynistic extremism as such a pressing issue. While some states have developed threat assessment centers that could be used to monitor radical incels, the federal government has not provided important leadership by labeling incels or misogyny a security threat, even though this is the number one indicator of a potential terrorist. Just overall, anyone who has been picked up on a terrorism charge, especially here in Australia, has a history of violence against women. And it doesn't matter what their background is or what their race is. It pretty much just goes to show that if you're a misogynistic woman beater, that you end up doing some extremist-ass shit and become a terrorist. And of course that, oh, not every fucking misogynistic-ass woman beater becomes a terrorist, but every terrorist starts off as a misogynistic-ass woman beater. Shit's fucked. All right, here's another one again from SBS. Open Queensland borders by 4 p.m. tomorrow or I'll take you to court, Pauline Henson tells state government. So, yes, the red-headed lady would like some attention again now, please. That she must have gotten sick of laying out in her paddock, and now she wants the writing angry letters to the Premier of Queensland to get the borders open again, because this apparently affects her. As this article says, the closures have been criticised by the tourism industry, which is bearing the brunt of job and financial losses. LNP MPs and the New South Wales Premier, who all believe they have gone on for too long, as in they're included in that. On Wednesday morning, Prime Minister Scott Morrison has challenged Liberal and Labor Premiers alike to justify state border closures to their residents. Now, this is the tourism industry, similar to Flight Centre, which was just mentioned earlier, which is a very laconic and aloof take on closing hundreds of their branches to save money. And just this fucking shit that Scott Morrison dragged kicking and screaming to actually fucking support people to close shit down and, you know, let people stay housed and alive during this pandemic. Now just wants things to pick up again. It's like, oh, we've had 2 months of things not being as bad as they could have been. Let's get back to it. But back to the article. Ms. Hanson's party sent a letter to Ms. Palaszczuk on Tuesday telling her she has until Thursday to respond in asking to see the documented advice and closures from the state's chief medical officer. Senator Hanson told Nine's Today program, so I don't, maybe Channel 9 convinced Hanson to jump ship from Sunrise, where she seems to get all this fucking free excess coverage, because Nine's Today program was fucking tanking. I don't know why anyone has their own TV. Anyway. A 90-day program that if the request is ignored, a challenge to the constitutionality of the closures will be filed to the High Court by the end of the week. The state government has previously dismissed the legal threat, saying it has to balance the timing of the reopening of the borders with medical advice. Now, as you can imagine, the Queensland is pretty much ignoring the letter and are not going forward with it. It has a mention here at the bottom of the article that, meanwhile, billionaire and United Australia Party leader Clive Palmer filed papers in the High Court beginning a similar challenge to Western Australia border restrictions. Talked about that. There's going to be more on him later. Here's something else. Just a quick one. I came across an article from Gizmodo, but I went straight to the source here. Citra emulator. This is apparently the best DS emulator you can get on your phone. What I'm seeing here is the is Portal on DS? Because that's what this fucking screenshot looks like. Anyway, if you've been reading my newsletter, which I know no one has, that I've been talking about how I've been using emulators to play a lot of old games, and I've been thinking about how to access DS games that, even though both my brother and my girlfriend have one, getting games for it would be a little bit tricky. I know that emulators are less than legal, but this seems like a good way around it. And I sort of like the idea of playing, you know, like Game Boy or DS games on my phone, so it's portable, a little bit more like how they are intended. Here's another one from Vox, because it's Vox, it's got too many words in it, so we'll skip through this pretty quickly. But Trump's latest travel ban targets Brazil. I mentioned Brazil last week. Everything is going extremely well there, as you can imagine. The article says, Brazil has the highest daily COVID-19 death rate worldwide and will see deaths increase fivefold by August to 125,000. President Jair Bolsonaro has prioritized keeping businesses open against the advice of these health ministers and described the virus as just a little flu, has yet to implement shutdown measures in order to slow the rate of infection. Things have been going so well in Brazil that the states is actually considering travel restrictions. Here's just another quick part from this article. It's not clear whether travel bans are effective at this stage. It has just a paragraph talking about the dickhead in the White House there. Then New Zealand, which brought the number of daily new coronavirus cases down to zero, and Australia, which has just over 7,000 cases, have both enacted strict lockdowns and sent overseas travellers to mandatory 14-day quarantine upon arrival. China and Italy, on the other hand, both adopted stringent restrictions of domestic and international travel, but were unable to avert the pandemic. So yeah, it's that some places work, some places don't. Hard to say. Moving on, another one from BNT again. This is a fucking weird one. Electronics giant LG embroiled in vile upskirting video posted to TikTok. Now, just a quick qualifier, this is part of a prank, so I don't believe this woman actually was a... non-consensually upskirted. It's just everything around this is fucking stupid. Okay, so opening lines here. Korean electronics brand LG is in total damage control after the company shared a vile video on social media of a sleazy old man upskirting a young woman with his phone as she walked up a flight of stairs. As it goes on to explain, the video was actually made by a prank creator who goes by the name of @Sawadega, and then for some unfathomable reason shared by LG Poland on its TikTok account. And, yeah, so the elderly man, who's actually an actor wearing prosthetics, which you can tell because he just looks so fucking wrinkly that no one who looked like that would be alive, is seen snapping videos of a woman who then realizes what's happening and angrily confronts him, taking the phone from him and going through the photo gallery. What she sees is nothing but selfies, thanks to the phone's ability to snap two pictures at once, that proves all the more sinister. So what it is, it seems like the phone... it can fold out, has two screens, and then because it's got this two-screen arrangement, you can have both your front-facing camera and the forward-facing camera operating at the same time. And I suppose when you take a photo, it snaps on both cameras, but it only displays one in the thumbnail. And in this case, it's displayed the selfie instead of the photo of the woman. It's like if you had to think up the most fucked up ad for this phone, that's pretty much what it is. And apparently LG Poland saw it and thought the exact same thing. So yeah, good on them. Here's another one from The Age. Yes, there is a right and wrong way to burn a scented candle. This is something that I almost wouldn't fucking believe, but here we fucking go. That, yeah, you can apparently burn a scented candle the wrong way. I'll breeze through this, and I'm going to skip a bit of it because it kind of functions as a fucking ad for the people that got quoted here. But as it says, A good scented candle should be handmade, contain no paraffins or petrochemical raw materials, no preservatives, parabens, or sulfates, and derive their scent from natural oils. The place that they spoke to get this advice, their candles cost $120. Which they say sounds like a lot, but equates to about $1.50 an hour if burned correctly. So that means you're going to get less than 10 hours out of, or is that 100 hours? Yeah, 100 hours. You're going to get slightly under that for a $120 scented candle. I'm sorry, but I don't think I like any of the women that I only passively know and have to buy presents for enough to spend $120 on a fucking candle. But as the points extend here, a good burn means lighting any candle for at least 3 hours to ensure the full circumference of the candle has melted, or else it will tunnel and burn unevenly for the remainder of its life. You may sacrifice half your candle in this process. So, yeah, at least it's good to know that there's a bit of an art to this and how to do it properly. Other good practices include trimming a candle's wick to 1 centimeter before lighting, and later using a special tool with a hook tip to extinguish to help coat the wick in wax to protect it until next use. They warn not to blow out a candle, as it will produce smoke, as well as allow the wick to continue smoldering, reducing it to an usable stump. What the fuck are these hook things for putting a candle out? Is that the one with the little bell on top? It seems like a lot of fucking work for a candle, doesn't it? Other advice, like it says, you got to let it burn, so check your diary, don't light a new candle if you have to dash out in an hour. Candle needs a good few hours on the first burn to establish a good wax memory. Set a timer. Subsequent burn should be 2 and 4 hours, and let the air clear if you're going to do another one. Buy a good wick trimmer and this hook-tipped extinguisher. I don't know what the fuck that is, because they will last for years. Because, yeah, if you're just using a bit of metal to put out a candle, not a whole lot of wear and tear on that motherfucker. All right, here we go. The fat cunt's read his ugly head again. From The Guardian, Clive Palmer launches High Court challenge to Queensland coronavirus border closure. So the court on Thursday afternoon heard that a similar case launched by Palmer challenging the Western Australian border closure would likely take at least 6 weeks to proceed to a hearing in mid-July. So probably by then, everything will be open and it will just seem irrelevant. Yeah, if I can say that, who knows how things will turn out. Peter Dunning, QC, representing Palmer, money-grubbing fucking cunt, told the court it was hoped the cases should dovetail. So he wants both of these cases to convene, and what, he can sue two states at once? I don't fucking know. Clive Palmer seems to me the most bored motherfucker in quarantine of all of us. So, yeah, before the court here on Thursday, Palmer released a statement calling the border closure in Queensland an injustice. I'm not going to read his actually an actual quote, but summary is he feels duty-bound to help the unemployed and the businesses that have been adversely affected. You know what he could have done? He could have actually paid the fucking employees of his nickel mine, saying that he's duty-bound to help motherfuckers. Shut up, you fat cunt. You fucking... Ugh. Moving on. Here's another one from The Register. FYI, there are thousands of Chrome extensions with so many fake installations to trick you into using them. And this is a bit of an interesting read. It says here that Julio Marin Torres has been highlighting suspiciously popular Chrome extensions since January in posts to the Chromium Extensions Forum, trying to get Googler, I imagine that's meant to just say Google, trying to get Google to enforce their store policies. In an email to The Register, he said Google has taken some action since his initial post on the subject, but the problem has only gotten worse since then. Something has to change, he said. I think this hurts the entire Chrome store developer and user community. I just imagine with a name like that, that's how he sounds. Pretty much what this is, a speculation, is that every shitty fucking extension you see there on the Chrome store, that the developers either contact someone to do it themselves, run a bunch of virtual machines to just install the extension over and over again, boosting its numbers, making it seem more legit. It says here, a list he posted on May 17th includes more than 80 Chrome extensions that purported to have massive numbers of users and yet have few, if any, user reviews. For example, the Fortnite new tab and wallpaper collection has over 1 million users and not a single person has bothered to post a review. In another post over the weekend, he identified the top 10 extensions with the most fake installations in the past 24 hours. In a day, the Naruto wallpaper HD custom new tab gained over 223,000 users, an increase of more than 800%. Fucking hell, huh? Yeah, so here's another thing here. It says that Torres said the buying and selling fake users involves bad developers, companies, crime groups, and bot farms, especially in China, India, and Russia. He provided the Register with a screenshot of a chat with an individual going by the name of Aleski offering fake installations for a monthly fee. So, this is what it says here from Aleski. Anyway, I have a service for delivering fake installs. Costs for 50k installs, $200 monthly. That's pretty fucking cheap, isn't it? For test, I can send 50k installs. Obviously, I don't share details on how it works. Other extension developers participating in the discussion have thanked Torres, noting that it's odd to criticize efforts to improve the Chrome Web Store unless you're part of the problem. Yeah, the Chrome Web Store feels a bit like the Windows Store in that it's just chock full of shit, and you're reluctant to download anything unless it comes from a legitimate website. I've got a couple of extensions running myself, but they're usually all linked back to something larger. You know, like you got that doesn't count, but I got Buffer, which I've used the website before, I know it's a real thing. I got Privacy Badger, which I know is a real thing. An ad blocker. Obviously, I got Pocket running. And, like, one thing they got rid of in Chrome is that you can't just use backspace to go back on a page. That if you want that as a feature, you had to get an extension. And I made sure, because this is the sort of thing you can imagine there'd be like thousands of fucking fake ones popping up. Well, not fake ones, but ones by other dodgy people like this. I made sure that I got the one actually made by Google. All right. Here's another quick one. That troubled cargo ship to be unloaded at Port of Brisbane. Now, initially I thought this is from The Age as well, just heads up. I thought this was the one I read a thing about, like a cargo ship with a bunch of masks that had fallen off. Not this one. But you may have seen this photo going around of all these tipped over shipping containers. It's a fucking sight. So, some 40 containers went overboard on Sunday when the ship struck rough seas off the coast of New South Wales. About 70 other containers were displaced, forcing the vessel, which was en route from China to Melbourne, to dock in Brisbane. ANL said it's cooperating with all investigators while cleanup operation on the way and other containers containing dangerous cargo. The contractor has been removing surface debris on New South Wales shoreline since yesterday, the company said on Thursday. Containers that have been reported on beaches and floating at sea will be removed as a matter of priority. Floating containers will be towed back to land where they will be removed. So no mention, aside from just things not being dangerous, of what's on there. But, yeah, it's just an interesting photo at the very least. All right, here's one from happymag.tv. Proof that the virus has gone too far. Sex workers recommend using reverse cowgirl to help curb coronavirus. Yeah, so it seems like if you're having sex, especially with a sex worker at the moment, you're not too concerned about it. It must be only a respiratory thing, because you'd think with sex there's an exchange of body fluids anyway. Like, can you catch it through that, or is it only a respiratory thing? But yeah, they're saying because of that, one of the recommended positions is reverse cowgirl, which, from the very few tweets from porn stars and sex workers I've seen, is the worst sex position. And this is from a list of recommendations that came out from Switzerland, because sex work is legal there, and they placed a temporary ban on all sex work 2 months ago. This also comes after New York City published guidelines for sex during the pandemic, and they weren't a fan of rim jobs, encouraging you to use sex dolls. And one of the other recommended positions, the much better one, is doggy style, which is pretty much just getting reverse cowgirl and rotating it forward 90 degrees. So that's where we're at. All right, we're coming up on an hour here, and I still got a lot of fucking tabs left. Maybe I'll do a second episode. Not like I need to worry about doing a fucking premium one. Anyway, Here's one from newdaily.com.au. Man cleared in sex fantasy identity mix-up. This one is a fucking read. So what happened is two men hired to carry out a stranger's sexual fantasy of being tied up while clad in his underpants, went to the wrong New South Wales rural address with machetes, but politely left after realizing their mistake. So at least there's that. And the judge said they carried the machetes either as a prop or something to use in that fantasy. The judge said he's established reasons for acquittal earlier in May. The fantasy was unscripted and there was discretion as to how it would be carried out. According to statements tendered at the brief judge alone trial, a man living in Goolgowie in western New South Wales near Griffith wanted to be tied up and have a broom handle rubbed around his underwear. He was willing to pay $5,000 if it was really good, the judge said. The would-be client had a history and proclivity for engaging the services of people, an officer said. So apparently what happened, and this is weird, is that he got in touch with some people on Facebook to enact this fantasy. He gave them his address. He moved house. He updated it. But it seems like in the same street as the first address, no some lights coming in his laundry. So what ended up happening is even though he moved house and gave him the new address, the classic thing you'd think is that they went to the old address. No, they went to the wrong house in the same street as the old address. This is just a fucking great read. I love this. But on July 14, a resident living in the same street as the first address noticed some light coming from his lounge room when he got up to go to the toilet. Assuming it was a friend who came daily to make a coffee, he yelled out, "Bugger off, it's too early." After hearing a voice ask if his name was that of the intended client, the resident turned on his bedside light, took off his sleep apnea mask, and saw two men standing next to his bed. They carried machetes pointed down towards the ground. They started to leave after he told them his name, which is not that of the intended client. One man apologized, saying, "Sorry, mate," and took the resident's hand, while the other said bye before they drove off. The resident then contacted the police. When the men and their driver arrived at the correct address, the would-be customer noticed one had a great big knife in his pants, which he put in the car after being told not to bring it inside. They had coffee and the client made bacon, eggs and noodles before Mr. Leroy fell asleep on the couch. Ooh, I shouldn't have said his name. So, yeah, they realized they fucked up, went to the actual guy's place. I guess they let him know what happened. And then they're just like, "Oi, we fucked up there, didn't we?" All right, this is coming up to an hour mark. I've still got, this is a little bit less than half of the tabs I had open. Maybe I'll record another one tomorrow or so. Do it again. That's probably a good way to manage all this shit. I'll leave it there for the moment. We can pick this up again later because, yeah, as you probably know, America is on fire at the moment. Yeah, everything's going well there in the great democratic experiment. It's not a failed state. I got a couple of things to talk about that and other shit. So I'll just do this one and catch you all again later. All right, bye.